of the prophecy of Isaiah. It is a commonplace of doctrine that man is not allowed to know the future. If he knew with assurance what events were coming on the morrow, or what the next year would have in store for him, or still more, if he knew beforehand what his eternal lot was to be, he would lose all incentive to use his human faculties. Either he would quail with fear, petrified by the anticipations of misfortune, or he would be lulled into a security that made any effort of his own seem unnecessary and vain. He would be deprived of all delight. He would seem a slave of circumstance, and all his actions would become a dull and vacant routine. For it is of the essence of every man's life to act as if the future depended on him, as indeed it does. It would be folly to think of the future as if it were a fixed mold of events, or a pattern of absolute necessities that leave no room for the free choice of man. For the Lord provides innumerable contingencies or alternatives among which man can choose. The fact of freedom rules out the idea of necessity. The Lord's government is a framework of divine and unalterable law, and it is as such that we may view the future. Nothing will ever happen that is opposed to these unchanging laws, for what is contrary to the laws of God is impossible. Yet what is seldom realized to the full is that all these laws have respect, first of all, to human freedom, and thus include laws of permission, laws that permit evil, while at the same time, no evil or disaster is ever permitted which takes away the spiritual freedom or the individual responsibility of any man. The wickedness of man may temporarily delay the exercise of such freedom, but eventually each human soul will stand before the Lord and be seen in the light of spiritual truth, seen as to the choice that he himself has made in states of utter freedom and according to his reason. Since the immortal fabric of the spirit can be woven only in states of freedom, it is therefore denied to man to know the future. Still, the prophet heard the Lord say, "Behold, former things have come to pass, and new things do I declare. Before they spring forth, I make you to hear them." What could these words mean but that there are ways by which man may know future things? We learn from doctrine that everyone is allowed to form conclusions about the future from his rational, and in this the reason is in its proper life. What would human life be if man was not allowed continually to look forward to uses and delights to come, to knowledge yet to be gained? How could we survive if we did not, by our reason, anticipate the needs of the future and prepare against its looming dangers? Surely, every task of today looks to eternity if it is to be of use. We must plan for coming generations and store our harvest rather than wasting what is not of immediate need. This is the function and responsibility of human freedom and of human reason, without which man would be lower than the beasts provide for coming needs, instincts which man lacks. Instead of instinct, which would ordain his entire life, man is given reason that he may vision the future and yet be free. It is when his reason is not enlightened, when it is obscured and led astray by merely natural and corporeal affections, it is then that his vision of the future becomes contorted and erroneous. What is it then that man's reason is able to see when it contemplates the unknown future? It cannot see with absolute certainty any individual event. Even the behavior of material things is predictable only on the basis of past performances or statistical calculations, and may vary owing to unknown factors. And among these factors must be counted that of human freedom, which contradicts necessity. Nor can reason foresee the progress of spiritual events with any absolute assurance. We can judge of the course and order of spiritual states only from the past, and only so far as we have learned to view the past in the light of the laws of providence revealed in divine revelation. For to reveal hidden things, we read, to reveal hidden things and to open future things belongs to God alone. Even the angels do not know things to come. The Lord alone knows them, and he to whom he deigns to reveal them. What man can know of the future, even if his rational is enlightened, is confined to the laws which govern the course of spiritual and natural life. It is that man may come to know these laws that the Creator endowed him with a reason by which he could order his experience into systematic knowledge, and gave him, through prophets and seers, a body of divine revelations to provide him with a field of spiritual experience from which he might draw a knowledge of spiritual laws. The entire Word of God is a revelation of these eternal laws, and thus an opening of future things. New things do I declare, saith the Lord. Before they spring forth, I make you to hear them. What in the future is more important to know than the laws and purposes of God and the conditions on which the end of creation can be achieved? And this is what the Spirit of the Word reveals. Yet in its letter, the Word seems to give more specific prophecies of the future. And throughout the world there are many pious men who observe the signs of these troublous times and point to the predictions of the apocalypse, thinking that we are now in the days when the sixth angel would pour out his vial of God's wrath, and the spirits of devils working miracles would go forth unto the kings of the whole world to gather them to battle in a last Armageddon. And others, believing that the day of doom is even nearer, cite the prophecy that Satan shall be loosed from his prison and go out to deceive the nations in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle in numbers like the sands of the sea, who would compass the camp of the saints about, only to be destroyed by fire from heaven. Throughout the history of Christendom, whenever natural disasters, wars, and social upheavals so suggested, Christians have applied such predictions to their own times and quaked in fear of the approaching end of the world. Nor is it realized among those who hold the scriptures as holy, except within the new church, that prophecy is never literally fulfilled or so intended, but that its symbolic form as historical prediction is meant only to hint that the spiritual laws of God, eternal laws of judgment and salvation, the application of which are for every age, for every individual. They do not wait on time, but are fulfilled wherever states have ripened for judgment. Because the Lord, in various ways and at diverse times, reveals these laws of spiritual life, of reformation and regeneration, and also the laws of spiritual judgment which concern the decline of the churches, the corruption of religion, and its inevitable consequences, he can say, as in the text, "Behold, the former things are come to pass, and new things do I declare. Before they spring forth, I make you to hear them." For to the wise, the past reveals the future. They see the spiritual logic, the internal justice that lies behind the events. They see the mercy and leading of providence, and know that nothing is permitted except for the end that some good may come out of it. We stand tonight on the eve of another earthly year, uncertain as to what circumstances may attend it, what may be demanded of us, what duties may call, what trials or joys, setbacks or victories may come. We know that much that will happen of good and of ill has roots in the past. Much good, for other men have labored and we are entered into their labors. Much evil, for the past was shaped by the free choice of men, and the cumulative results of their neglects and our own failures will surely catch up with us. It is of the Lord's mercy that we cannot know ahead the good and the evil that are to come, except by the surmise of reason and the experience of the past. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. The Lord gives men strength for the tasks of the day, even as we pray him to give us each day our daily bread. And if we knew the blessings of tomorrow, we would not value them aright. But this we know from reason as well as from revelation, that behind the turmoils of nations which mark the course of history, there runs unbroken the serene stream of divine providence. Behind the noise of arms and the show of force and the rise and fall of vaunted theories and the competitions of economic life with its contrasts of wealth and poverty, of struggle and security, there breathes the real life of mankind, with its familiar story of simple joys and earnest endeavors and of kindliness and neighborly help, the story of love and of birth and of innocence and of tender parental care, repeated in unending generations, which all in turn display the same yearnings to explore and embrace the gifts of life, and employ their human faculties to reach the greater freedom of reasoned conduct. The triumph of the conqueror is brief. At length, it is the meek that will inherit the earth. The fundamental natural laws, which proceed from the Lord as universal spheres of protection and procreation, and which the Lord instills in every man, lead back modify crime and hold ambition within bounds. They allow reason to be restored after impatient passion has had its day, and they help to rebuild its ruins. They furnish that unquenchable flame of hope, which is the essence of reason's own delight as it looks at the new possibilities of a future in which the bowers of love can again be furnished in peaceful enterprise. But natural love can do no more than preserve the bare externals of society. For again and again, it becomes the tool of evil. What it cannot gain by right, it seeks to possess by force. It is the place of the rational mind to plan and provide for the uses of the future. But when self-love beclouds one's reason, it magnifies the importance of one's own plans and resolves, and confuses what is in itself a matter of indifference with what is essential. Self-love stubbornly insists on its own fixed ideas, its own ambitions. If it cannot have its own way, it raves insanely against providence. And in his wisdom, the Lord may then permit as a lesser evil the thing on which man insists, knowing that man can learn his folly only through failures. The man of the church must therefore examine his plans in the light of the indications of providence and the chief signs of the approval of providence are that what he proposes is in concord with the doctrine of charity and can be achieved with justice and good judgment, and that it does not deprive others of their legitimate uses or their spiritual freedom. For what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God? Only so, only by spiritual love, which springs from a love to the Lord, can the kingdom of heaven be established on earth. The wars and conflicts that affect the church are the combats of spiritual temptations, fought out in the privacy of each man's heart. It is on the outcome of such temptations with those who are of the Lord's specific church on earth that the quality of the future depends.